Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Friday, the 6th of September. Our main stories: the architect of President Trump's long-delayed Middle East peace plan, Jason Greenblatt, announces his resignation. The Irish Prime Minister, Leo Varadkar, says there'll need to be checks on the border with Northern Ireland if there's a no-deal Brexit. And Hurricane Dorian lashes America's east coast, flooding parts of Charleston in South Carolina. Also in this podcast,
he said, "Your own success is very important, but please also contribute to the development of the country by having a baby."
Why a South Korean politician has been publicly rebuked and accused of sexism. Plus, we get the findings of the largest ever study of ancient DNA. President Trump has called it the deal of the century, but the man behind America's much-delayed Middle East peace plan is stepping down. After nearly 3 years at the White House, Jason Greenblatt is apparently keen to return to his wife and six children in New Jersey. It's not clear if he'll stay on long enough to see the proposal published. It won't be before the Israeli elections on the 17th of September. I heard more about his resignation from our Middle East analyst, Sebastian Usher.
He said he'd only spend 2 years in the job. He's been more than 2 years. It's almost 3 years. But obviously, there must be more going on. We don't know if it is to do with internal politics within the Trump administration. Possibly, remember, Jason Greenblatt came to this as a trusted aide of President Trump's over many years as one of his top lawyers, a real estate lawyer. I mean, that was one of the things about him. You know, what experience does this man have of diplomacy, of the Middle East, etc.? But it also will make people think about this fabled peace plan, the one that President Trump has described as the ultimate deal, which we're yet to see. The latest that Mr. Greenblatt was saying just a few days ago was that after its latest delay, it's likely to be revealed after the Israeli election that's coming up this month. So whether he'll still be there, Mr. Greenblatt, for that or not, is an open question.
President Trump has tweeted his praise of Jason Greenblatt's dedication to Israel and said he'd been a loyal and a great friend and a fantastic lawyer. I mean, what will the Palestinians have made of him?
Just as they have with the peace plan, they essentially don't believe that it was ever balanced, that it took into consideration their concerns, but it was massively biased towards Israel, rightly or wrongly. And they will see Jason Greenblatt going as another sign that the deal hasn't really been meant that seriously, despite everything else. So, you know, there might be a sort of hope in a way that this peace plan won't actually emerge now. But I shouldn't think they'll expect that anything will improve as far as the Trump administration's view of the Palestinians' role in the Middle East peace process. But Israel, as far as President Trump is concerned, as far as his advisors are concerned, remain the most important element of that. And Israel's interests come first. It might be interesting to note that Brian Hook, who within the Trump administration has been the specialist on Iran, is also moving in to take more of a role in this plan, which again fits into this narrative that the Arab world, in a sense, the Gulf states, have moved to some extent away from the Palestinian being the key issue. They are now more interested in building a coalition against Iran. And if Israel, obviously being the most vociferous of all in the region about this, can play a part in that, then they're willing to build a rapprochement with Israel. And we've been seeing that increasingly in the past year or so.
Sebastian Usher. 4 days after it made landfall in the Bahamas as the second most powerful hurricane on record, Dorian is now menacing the US East Coast. By Thursday afternoon local time, the eye of the storm was passing Myrtle Beach in South Carolina, and it was expected to track the coastline into the evening before possibly making landfall again in North Carolina. The state's governor, Roy Cooper, has told residents there to prepare for the worst.
Hurricane Dorian is ready to unleash its fury on our state. The storm has regained strength. It is serious, and it can be deadly. The message this morning is this: get to safety and stay there. Don't let your guard down. The eye of the storm would be close enough to cause extensive damage in North Carolina.
Well, in South Carolina, more than 200,000 people are without power, and there was flooding in the city of Charleston. Our correspondent Gary O'Donoghue spoke to me from there.
It is still blowing very hard here, and the rain is still coming, although the rain has eased a little bit this morning. It was pretty continuous and pretty torrential. And they're looking at something in the region of over 40 centimetres of rain in the sort of 24-hour period in this region, which, if you think about it, is an astonishing amount of water. Just as I'm speaking to you, we're getting high tide here in Charleston as well, and that's one of the key sort of worrying points for the local authorities here, because the combination of the rain from the sky and the high tide and the storm surge whipped up by Dorian is the thing that could really create much more serious flooding in the city than we've already seen. So we're waiting to see how that plays out. As I'm speaking to you as well, the storm is sort of off the coast from where we are now, pretty much parallel to us. So we're getting the brunt of it now, I think, as it moves up the coast towards North Carolina. And you heard the warnings there from the governor in North Carolina.
Gary O'Donoghue in Charleston in South Carolina. Well, when Dorian hit the Bahamas, it brought winds of 295 kilometres an hour and it killed at least 20 people. Floodwaters are now receding, but 70,000 people are in need of immediate aid, according to the UN. Our correspondent, Aleem McBool, sent this report from Grand Abaco in the Bahamas.
Hurricane Dorian first made landfall right here. Its record-breaking winds and massive ocean surges have left behind a surreal landscape. Shipping containers and boats flipped far into the land, trees without a bit of vegetation on them, many of which have been uprooted or snapped in half, and we're yet to see a single building that hasn't suffered considerable damage. But there's worse. I'm looking out over an area which until last week thousands of people had called home, a huge shantytown in Marsh Harbour. It's been entirely levelled. People like Gary LaFreeze now root around to find any of their belongings.
Poor people, no house, no food, no water, you know, so no life for me too.
Some aid helicopters are starting to come here, but the needs are massive. And there are those, of course, who are beyond help. Many in this area tell us of people who are still missing. And while most did manage to shelter in churches or schools, in the heat there is the unmistakable smell of death.
Aleem McBool in the Bahamas. When it comes to manufacturing and technology, South Korea is renowned for its high levels of productivity. But there is one area of life where the country is falling behind. Babies. South Korea has one of the lowest birth rates in the world. The government has spent billions trying to persuade couples to have more children. But one politician has faced huge criticism and allegations of sexism after telling a female professor who didn't have children that she had failed to, quote, fulfil her duties to the nation. Luke Jones heard more from BBC Korean's Julie Yoon-Young Lee.
This Jung-Gap Yoon, he is a member of the conservative position, Liberty Korea Party. The thing happened at the confirmation hearing at the National Assembly in Korea of the, you know, the first female nominee for head of the country's Fair Trade Commission. And he mentioned some very sexist comment to the nominee.
He said,
I guess you're not married yet. So what do you think about the biggest problem in South Korea society right now? And it's birth rate. So the birth rate will end up running our country. And he said, your own success is very important, but please also contribute to the development of the country by having a baby.
So he was basically having a go at her for having a career and not having children. What have people around South Korea made of this?
Of course, after this remark, you know, there's such a big backlash in South Korea. A lot of people, you know, mention that this is a very sexist comment. And, you know, as she has a beautiful career and very experienced, but he actually underestimated her career by saying this sexist comment.
And this is a big point of contention in South Korea because the birth rate is incredibly low.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, the South Korea has one of the lowest birth rate in the world. That's true. And we Korean people are aware of that. And South Korean government attempt to make couple to have more children at the moment. And at this point, the country's fertility rate is almost 0.98 last year, which means less than one baby per woman.
And so as shocking as these comments might have been for this politician, for many people, is this something with what you've just told us. Is this something which many South Koreans are thinking?
Well, actually, right now in Korea, the anti-marriage movement is a very serious problem, and it is happening right now. A lot of young people are reluctant to have children or get married. This is mainly because once you get married or having a children, raising families costs a lot of money, and, you know, buying a house is very difficult because of all due to the high cost. And, you know, as you might know, the Korea has a very conservative work culture right now. So once women get married and have a children, it is really hard to balance out the work and her life balance and raise kids and going to work. It's really, really hard. So a lot of people are, once they get married, they easily lose their job and just give up their career.
Julie Yoon-Young Lee of the BBC Korean Service. And there is another government desperate to boost its birth rate, but for very different reasons. The Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has long been a hardline advocate of the argument that Europe is facing an existential threat, be it from immigration or multiculturalism. And now he's proffered a simple solution: bigger families. Tim Franks got the details from our Central Europe correspondent Nick Thorpe.
Mr. Orban has consistently, as the leader of a right-wing, a nationalist, a sovereignist government in the last 9 years he's been in power, he has strongly promoted what he believes are family values. Hungary has introduced in the last couple of months some of the most generous, one could say, state intervention, tax incentives, many other welfare moves to encourage families, especially middle-class families, to have more children.
Demography has a reputation of operating on a far longer time span than politics or governments. But is there any evidence that these tax incentives from Mr. Orban are bearing fruit in terms of the size of families?
There is some sign. Certainly the number of weddings, of marriages, are strongly up consistently in Hungary. Also the number of babies born per woman of fertile age is up during his rule from 1.2 per woman to 1.49. So there is a steady increase. It's difficult to say, of course, whether that's a result of these moves from the government, but the government can prove some progress in this field. Interestingly, Mr. Orban himself said that Hungary, while he feels they're making progress, that couples are having more babies in a relatively, you know, moderate sense, he did say that Hungary hasn't reached the tipping point, that would only come, the point he's trying to reach, he said, is when couples feel that they will be better off if they have children than they would be if they don't have children.
Nick Thorpe. And still to come.
We're creating a platform where people can come, they can feel at home, they can feel relaxed while still doing something that has never been done before.
The hotel that is literally out of this world. The Prime Minister of Ireland, Leo Varadkar, has said there will have to be checks on the Northern Ireland border if there is a no-deal Brexit. The Taoiseach, as he's known, was speaking to British and Irish business leaders in Dublin. The border on the island of Ireland will become the frontier between the UK and EU when Britain leaves. The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has said there'll be no need for a hard border, even if the UK departs without a deal. Mr. Varadkar disagrees.
There will be checks on goods and on live animals. And as far as possible, these will take place in the ports, airports and at business level. But some may need to take place near the border. We're working out the details of this with the European Commission, and we'll inform the public and business as soon as we know what the outcome will be.
Well, MPs here have passed a bill demanding that the British Prime Minister asks Brussels for a new extension rather than pursuing a no-deal Brexit. Mr. Johnson said on Thursday he would rather be dead in a ditch than ask to delay Brexit beyond the 31st of October. He's called for a general election next month to break the deadlock in Parliament, but Labour and other opposition parties say he must rule out a no-deal Brexit first. Pat Lee, the Irish Times political editor, says the position of the government in Dublin will add further pressure.
I think the government is edging its way towards giving a full picture of what a no-deal Brexit will mean in practical terms, especially with regard to the border. This was the most comprehensive description, I think, that the Taoiseach has given about the consequences of no deal. He did also, of course, list the things that wouldn't change between Ireland and the UK in the event of a no deal because of the common travel area, which stands separate to the EU agreements. But he also said, for the first time from him, that there would be checks needed on some goods close to the border. Interestingly, his pre-supplied script, supplied by government buildings, said that there would be some checks close to the border, whereas while delivering it, he softened that line slightly and said that there may be some checks near the border. But I think this is the direction that the government has been moving in recent weeks. I think we'll see more of it over the coming weeks, because while the government has steadfastly insisted that it wants to see the withdrawal agreement passed, that it sticks to the backstop on the withdrawal agreement, it's now becoming very obvious that the withdrawal agreement, as it is currently constituted, is unlikely to be agreed. So there is either a change to the withdrawal agreement or there is no deal. And as everybody over there and over here can see as well, that the most likely outcome, it seems, at this stage is a no deal.
Pat Lee, political editor of the Irish Times. Well, the British Prime Minister was dealt another blow on Thursday when his brother, Joe Johnson, resigned from his cabinet because of disagreements over Brexit. Our political editor, Laura Koonsberg, caught up with Boris Johnson.
Your brother has quit this afternoon, saying you're not acting in the national interest. What do you say to that? You must be concerned.
Well, I want to thank Joe very much for everything that he's done. He's been a fantastic minister for science and for the universities. And I think that we certainly haven't seen eye to eye for a long time about the UK and the European Union. But on a huge domestic agenda, I think he's done a fantastic job.
You're stuck, aren't you? Because Parliament won't allow you to leave without a deal. They won't right now allow you to get the election that you so desire. You're stuck.
Well, I have to say, I do think it is absolutely unbelievable that the leader of the opposition is currently refusing to have an election. I don't think ever in democratic history has a leader of the opposition refused to have an election.
How will you make it happen?
What he should do,
because you're stuck.
What he should do is allow the people to decide.
The British Prime Minister Boris Johnson talking to the BBC political editor Laura Koonsberg. Well, all this talk of a possible election appears to have prompted young people to sign up to vote. Nearly 200,000 Britons have registered in just 3 days, more than half of them under the age of 25. Many were too young to vote in the 2016 referendum and now want to make sure their voices are heard. Callum Leslie spoke to some of the newly enrolled voters.
It's been really interesting, you know, definitely a sense of seeing all this Brexit drama going on right back to after the referendum, seeing what's happening in Parliament. And whatever someone's opinion, you know, feeling like they can't do anything to influence it in any way. One of them's Olivia. She's at university in Liverpool. She's 20 and she'll be a first-time voter at the next election.
Yeah, it's been deeply frustrating having to watch, having not being able to do anything about it. Like, I was a few months off turning 18. I just had to watch the chaos and everything.
And then there's Riley. He's also 20. He works as a builder in Leeds and he sounds pretty ready for it.
I am excited at the prospect of being able to vote because I can finally have my say in something, and I've had enough time now to be able to stand back and think and have an idea of actually what's going on.
We do usually see more registrations around now, and as you say, people moving to new university halls, it often means they're changing where they can vote. But even taking all that into account, this is a bigger number than normal. We spoke to one expert earlier who said it's several times bigger than you'd expect for early September. And what's especially unusual is that we've not even had an election called yet. So that might give us an idea of how much all that talk's having a bit of cut through with young voters. And just to give you an idea of those numbers, you mentioned that 200,000 figure. Well, 118,000 of those are between 18 and 35.
Callum Leslie. South Africa has temporarily closed its embassy in Nigeria, saying it can no longer ensure the safety of its staff. Tensions between the two nations have been growing after violence in Johannesburg this week. Mobs looted and destroyed shops in the South African city, many of them owned by Nigerians. More than 420 arrests were made. South Africa's foreign minister, Naledi Pandor, says the violence was an embarrassment, but that hasn't stopped reprisal attacks in Abuja in Nigeria. Julian Marshall discussed the situation with our Nigeria correspondent, Mayeni Jones, in Lagos, and first Johannesburg-based journalist Sam Mkoleli.
We've seen in the past week or so locals out in the streets and demonstrating violently with your local stores owned by foreigners and also some owned by locals were looted. To say it's a xenophobic attack or xenophobic flare-up is to simplify the issue, because really what is in the air is in South Africa is a sense of despair and a great deal of frustration with the economic setup where people do not have jobs and the economy is really growing at dismal numbers. And the forecast for the year is way below 1% growth when you have officially up to almost a third of the population unemployed.
Mayeni, Sam, they're arguing that the violence wasn't necessarily directed against foreigners and that there are underlying reasons for it. But nonetheless, how was that violence in South Africa reported in Nigeria?
Well, here in Nigeria, there's been a lot of anger, both on the part of the government and also Nigerian citizens. There's been a lot of misinformation and fake news on social media, pictures from previous xenophobic attacks in South Africa in 2008 and 2015 have been circulating on social media, claiming to be from the last 2 days. That has led to a lot of anger on the streets of some of Nigeria's main cities, including Lagos and Abuja, where we saw attacks on South African-owned businesses on Tuesday and Wednesday, including the supermarket ShopRite, but also the telecoms giant MTN and a number of other businesses here.
Sam, you say that there is a certain amount of confusion as to whether these latest attacks were xenophobic in nature, but it is the case, is it not, that there have been previous outbreaks of xenophobic violence in South Africa in 2008 and 2015, most notably?
Yeah, of course. I mean, there is a xenophobic element in that foreign shops are being targeted. Some people see the foreign nationals as a people who come to South Africa to take their already scarce opportunities and resources. And some people would have a view that there's a drug problem in South African society, and some of the drug peddlers are foreign nationals and they are undocumented and they come to South Africa and behave in an illegal manner. So there is a xenophobic element.
Sam Mkoleli in Johannesburg and Mayeni Jones in Nigeria talking to Julian Marshall. How did Indo-European languages, which are today spoken from Britain to South Asia, spread around the ancient world? Well, a study of human DNA thousands of years old has revealed the likely answer, as well as throwing light on how farming developed in South Asia. The project was led by David Reich from Harvard Medical School.
We obtained whole DNA, whole genome sequences from 524 skeletons of individuals who lived mostly between 12,000 years ago and 2,000 years ago in Central and South Asia. And we analyzed them to understand how they're related to each other and to people living today. We have three main results. One is that farming, which first arose in the Fertile Crescent of the Middle East 12,000 years ago, spread eastward with a mixture of ancestry that was common in Anatolia, present-day Turkey, and Iran beginning 8,000 years ago and spread all the way to Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan with this mix of Anatolian ancestry. However, that ancestry barely or almost did not get at all to South Asia. So while farming arose in South Asia 8,000 years ago or a little afterward, the ancestry that spread to its north and west associated with farming didn't spread there. So farming in South Asia arose through local hunter-gatherers adopting it either through new invention or the spread of ideas from the west, not through movement of people, a very different history. However, we do find a major impact into South Asia between 4,000 to 3,500 years ago of a ancestry descended from people from the steppe north of the Black and Caspian Seas who came in between 4,000 and 3,500 years ago and contributed up to 30% of the ancestry of people in South Asia today. In South Asia, the languages spoken in the north, which are Indo-European languages, are linked closely to those like Baltic and Slavic languages in Europe, and we've now now documented a chain of transmission of ancient cultures that goes along with the spread of languages.
And does this tell us anything about the state of the world in those ancient times?
Well, it highlights the great interconnectedness of Eurasia. It highlights in particular the two parallel histories of South Asia and of Europe. Both places are the result largely of mixture of three highly divergent ancestral populations, the local hunter-gatherers of both Europe and South Asia, incoming ancestry related to the spread on its periphery and among the first farmers of the region, and finally an impact of steppe pastoralists. That mixture of three populations in both places produced two later mixed populations, and the mixture of those mixed populations drives the primary variation in both subcontinents of Eurasia today.
David Reich of Harvard Medical School. Have you ever wondered what it's like to travel through space? Well, some companies are hoping to make money from people who want to experience it at first hand. Analysts believe space tourism could be a multi-billion dollar industry within years. Several firms have already announced plans to begin commercial flights into space, but now there is a plan for the first ever space hotel. The Von Braun Space Station aims to have 100 tourists a week by 2025. This report from Richard Hamilton.
A scene from Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, in which a craft docks onto Space Station 5. While the Von Braun space station has some similarities to Kubrick's invention, it'll be shaped like an enormous wheel, it'll be a lot less sterile, according to the designer, Tim Alatorre.
The average person doesn't want to go to space and be in a laboratory or a factory, and that's essentially what the International Space Station is currently. So we're creating a platform where people can come, they can feel at home, they can feel relaxed while still having an out-of-this-world experience and doing something that has never been done before. So we're using warm lighting, natural materials, soft textures as much as possible. We're not going for the Stanley Kubrick 2001 Space Odyssey all plastic, white, bright light environment. We're looking at something that's a lot more familiar, a lot more comfortable.
This extraterrestrial hotel is named after the controversial rocket scientist Wernher von Braun, who was affiliated to the Nazi Party in Germany, but later became the director of NASA's Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama. The interior design is inspired by von Braun's drawings from the 1950s and will have a retro feel, but with all the benefits of modern technology. It'll be the first of its kind to have artificial gravity, so guests won't find themselves or their belongings flying around in the air. There'll also be restaurants, bars, a movie theater, and even a supersized basketball court.
Richard Hamilton. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.